KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On today's show, a jury of your peers. What does that mean? And should non-citizens get a chance to serve in the jury box? The governor will soon decide. And mapping the brain to understand epileptic seizures and what it's teaching scientists about other conditions like depression and dyslexia.
This really helps us understand, for example, the origin of psychological disorders. There are people who see the reality very differently than us.
Plus, two new exhibits with blueprints of grand architectural visions for things that never got built. And defying the age of digital publishing, a huge bookstore thrives in downtown Los Angeles.
There's still a lot of people who want the physical experience of holding a book, of smelling a book, of reading from pages instead of an e-reader.
It's the California Report. We begin today with what you might call the cornerstone of the U.S. legal system. It's a duty of citizenship that arouses mixed feelings. Jury duty.
Long, stressful, and I think at times it could be intriguing.
Mandatory, drudgery, bureaucratic.
Could be entertaining, could be boring.
Time-consuming, dull, dry.
In all 50 states, only U.S. citizens can serve on juries, but one of the bills on Governor Jerry Brown's desk would make California the first state where non-citizens are eligible for jury service.
There's no compelling reason why they should automatically be disqualified.
That's Bob Wieckowski, a San Francisco Bay Area Democrat who chairs the Assembly Judiciary Committee. He says expanding the jury pool by including permanent legal residents makes sense in a state with more than 3 million green card holders.
They're permanently here. Their participation makes the deliberations and the legitimacy of the decisions that they come to that much better.
Wieckowski's bill, AB 1401, passed the legislature without a single Republican vote. And the process left a lot to be desired, says Oceanside Assemblyman Rocky Chavez.
The last day of session, the last closing hours, we have a bill being pushed from the Senate over to the Assembly, never being vetted or talked about at all anywhere on the Assembly floor.
Chavez says the bill tries to solve a problem that doesn't exist. There's no shortage of potential jurors who are citizens, he says. Chavez sees the whole thing as a political wedge issue.
It's clear to me that eventually it gets down to the issue of immigration and the intent to paint Republicans as people who are against immigrants.
But supporters of AB 1401, including Assemblyman Wieckowski, see it as a matter of fairness and discrimination, a logical step toward ensuring that juries reflect the entire population. The Assemblyman points out that back in the 1950s, when the film 12 Angry Men came out, women were often missing from juries. He sees opening the jury pool to green card holders as a logical next step in making juries more inclusive. But Professor John Eastman at Chapman University Law School in Orange County doesn't see it that way at all. Eastman thinks the country's founders envisioned juries composed strictly of citizens, a way for them to check the power of government.
And the notion that we would allow non-citizens to perform that duty is no different than saying we should allow non-citizens to perform the basics of voting and determine the direction of government. It's that important.
In a San Francisco courtroom this week, Superior Court Judge Kay Sennin was overseeing jury selection for a murder trial.
What we're going to do right now is we're going to actually put 12 or 24 people into what we call the jury box. Or the box.
It's a diverse group with Latinos, Asians, and African Americans. All of them are citizens.
It's a process of selecting a fair and unbiased and unprejudiced jury, and that's why we need your honest responses.
Critics of AB 1401 say non-citizens might not share American values. That could matter, they argue, in trials where juries consider issues like domestic violence, the role of women, or the importance of questioning authority. But supporters of the change say the jury selection process gives attorneys and judges a voice in who sits in the jury box. UCLA immigration law professor Hiroshi Motomura adds that the bill would give non-citizens in the legal system a stronger sense of being judged by their peers.
The problem that this bill would solve in some communities, the jury that doesn't really look like the community, and so it may undermine a fair trial.
So what about green card holders? How do they feel about the prospect of jury duty? I met with two of them this week to hear their thoughts. Eleanor Zwinger came to the U.S. 14 years ago from Germany, where questions of the law are settled by legal experts. There is no jury system. An attorney by training, Zwinger questions whether ordinary people, with little or no legal training, have the skills to make good jurors.
If I were called, I would do what I am required to do, but I wouldn't be behind it with my full heart.
Sitting next to her, Abdiel Oñate disagrees. A native of Mexico, the university history professor, sees jury duty as a chance for legal residents to participate more fully in civic activities with long-term benefits.
When you apply for citizenship, then you will see that you have performed already the obligations and know what citizenship requires. Not only you have rights, but obligations also as a citizen.
The question now is, how does Jerry Brown see jury service? As an obligation, a right, or a privilege that should be reserved only for U.S. citizens? And what exactly does a jury of your peers mean? The governor has until October 13th to make up his mind. People with serious epilepsy are debilitated by seizures. Surgery can cure the problem, but only after doctors learn exactly where and how the seizures are triggered. And that requires watching the human brain in action. KQED science reporter Amy Standen met one patient who's volunteered to let scientists study his brain by opening it up. She brings us this report.
In his back pocket, Nate Bennett carries around a black leather wallet about the size of an envelope and attached to a keychain.
Yep. This wallet that I've designed, piece of Velcro, you see it's full of bite marks.
His teeth have left deep scars in the leather. That's a good sign. It means he had time to prepare.
I tend to bite my tongue during the grand mal portion of the seizure. So if I'm conscious and I feel the seizure starting, I warn people around me what's going on. I lay down on the floor. I put this in my mouth.
From the outside, a seizure looks like a brain in a state of chaos, total disorder. But in fact, it's the opposite. Robert Fisher, director of the Stanford Epilepsy Center, says a seizure is when millions of neurons suddenly start firing in lockstep.
So instead of the chatter that you might see in a football stadium before the game starts, now it's like the wave or like the cheer after a touchdown where everybody's doing the same thing at once.
In centuries past, this looked a lot like a spiritual possession. Joan of Arc may have had epilepsy, St. Teresa de Avila. But over time, scientists have learned that epilepsy is a window into the brain. Nate's seizures have gotten to the point where he can't drive, can't work. He's worried about losing his health insurance, and medication isn't helping. That makes him a candidate for surgery to remove the part of his brain that's causing the seizures and effectively cure his epilepsy. At Stanford Hospital, where he's being treated, there are two stages to this process. First, a surgery to implant electrodes into his brain. In this case, thin plastic wires, each about an inch and a half long. I visit him as he's waking from anesthesia. He's groggy, but he gives me a thumbs up.
Putting reality back together here, gradually.
He says, I think I can tell you my full name.
Nathaniel Walter Bennett, right? Yep. Always a good start.
A doctor tells Nate what happened while he was in surgery.
I've got five or six electrodes at this point.
Seven electrodes. Two on the right and then five on the left.
Wow, what a party.
The point of these electrodes is to record exactly what happens in Nate's brain when he has a seizure. That would tell his doctors where his seizures are coming from, and thus what part of his brain to remove. This means spending a week or more in the hospital, mostly waiting for seizures to strike. The day after his surgery, Nate's head is swathed in bandages. A thick braid of electrical wires hangs from his left temple.
Hanging in there, I'd kind of like to have a seizure.
Before they remove part of Nate's brain, his team also needs to do some basic mapping. Where exactly are the parts of his brain that control his vision, for example, his motor control? These are things you want to know before you take out the scalpel.
So take a deep breath and just relax.
Nate's doctor is Yosef Parvizi, a neurologist at Stanford who specializes in epilepsy. Today, Parvizi's going to send tiny electrical pulses into Nate's brain, too small to cause him any pain.
I want you to tell us if you feel anything that resembles your seizures, okay?
Deal.
1, 2, 3.
Felt like somebody was poking me with a finger right here.
Parvizi then sends a signal to a part of the brain involved in automatic speech, like saying ouch or laughing.
Let me know if anything changes, okay?
Change.
Suddenly, Nate lurches forward.
I became unable to speak, and I was going to say jinx. I started stuttering. I couldn't get the words out.
Some of this is helpful for understanding Nate's epilepsy, but some of it is pure science, an opportunity, really, for mind control, basically to zap the brain and see what happens. For Nate, it's painless, a way to pass the time. But for Parvizi and other researchers, it's amazing access. Working with epilepsy patients like Nate, they've identified parts of the brain involved in forming words, in counting. They've been able to take these abilities and literally turn them on and off, like a light switch. Take, for example, in this video clip from another of Parvizi's patients, when the man suddenly loses his ability to recognize faces.
You just turned into somebody else.
Tell me
about your face metamorphosis. Your nose got saggy, went to the left. You almost looked like somebody I'd seen before, but somebody different. That was a trip.
Did I keep my gender?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did you know I'm not a female?
Because you're still wearing a suit and tie.
Oh, you could see the suit and tie?
Yeah. Only your face changed.
The idea is that when you start learning where certain abilities live in the brain, you come closer to finding new ways to fix them when they break down. Take, for example, in dyslexia or depression.
This really helps us understand, for example, the origin of psychological disorders. There are people who see the reality very differently than us. We can't just blame them. We just need to understand how their brain is working in a way that they are seeing the reality in a different way.
Parvizi wants to wait for Nate to have a natural seizure, but he also wants to stimulate the part of Nate's brain that causes the seizures, and he knows doing this might trigger one, which is what happens.
Yeah, there is a change.
Open your eyes.
And I might have a seizure.
Okay.
It seems very similar. Yeah.
Nate's face hardens, his eyes fix on some invisible spot across the room.
Very clammy. Very clammy.
A doctor injects Nate with a dose of Ativan to stop the seizure. A nurse ushers me out of the room. When I next look in, Nate is sleeping peacefully. His seizure has been recorded, his brain mapped at the finest level of detail possible with today's technology, bringing him, hopefully, one step closer to a life without epilepsy. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
For every Golden Gate Bridge or Hollywood sign, there are hundreds of ideas on the cutting room floor that never came to be. But now, for the first time, you can see models and blueprints of some of these abandoned projects from two of California's most iconic cities. As Alex Schmidt reports, museums in San Francisco and L.A. reveal quirky and often ingenious buildings that just don't exist.
So do you think this is the best place to talk about Steel
right
Cloud?
Over there. Yeah, probably
right over there.
Right in the middle.
I'm in downtown Los Angeles with Greg Golden and Sam Lubell, the curators of the LA exhibit called Never Built.
I don't have to take too many deep breaths.
The gaping trench of the 101 freeway belches and roars beneath us. But a different vision for this space was floated in 1988, a cultural center called Steel Cloud that was 10 stories tall and boasted movie theaters, galleries, a pair of aquariums.
What was it described as, like a grasshopper?
That's curator Greg Golden.
There's all kinds of pejoratives that were used to describe the Steel Cloud. And yeah, it was messy, it was informal, but frankly, it would have been amusing, you know, to have an aquarium hovering over a freeway in downtown. Great. Why not?
This is one of dozens of never-built projects in the exhibit at LA's Architecture and Design Museum. There are theme parks, one of them in the shape of a heart called Bible Storyland, housing projects, a floating airport. Another unbuilt show just opened in San Francisco.
The first thing you want to learn when you hit Alcatraz is keep your mouth shut, walk with your back to the wall. I'm Pat Mahoney, former Alcatraz correctional officer, and I'll be your guide.
Today, you can take an elaborate tour through Alcatraz's hulking prison. But in the late 60s, American Indian activists occupied the island in hopes of claiming the land. They had plans drawn up, which you can see in the show, to rid Alcatraz of its buildings and turn it into a residential community and cultural center. Even though the village never became reality, the occupation gained concessions for American Indians and led to the preservation of Alcatraz.
There's kind of a shadow landscape that things get done because of the things that didn't get done.
That's John King, a curator of the Unbuilt SF exhibit, which is showing at UC Berkeley and other sites. Another piece in the show features a 1945 rendering of the headquarters of the newly formed United Nations at the base of Twin Peaks. It came complete with an illuminated globe and skyscraper. The San Francisco curators came to the idea of an unbuilt exhibit independent of the LA show. But there may be something to the fact that there are two of these shows happening in California right now. Curator John King again.
California is a place that by its nature tends to attract people who want to live their lives a different way. This is a place where people want to have the life they want to have. And so that creates a certain restlessness to try and imagine a future.
Another imagined future that didn't happen would have dramatically altered the tallest peak in the Hollywood Hills in service of a museum to Hollywood industry. LA curator Greg Golden.
So the pinnacle of Mount Hollywood would have been shaved down by approximately 30 feet, and they would have flattened this natural peak, and on top of that would have been a star-shaped museum, and then, of course, a revolving restaurant, because revolving restaurants were the big thing, and an aerial tram to get you up to this Hollywood museum.
Some of the projects in these shows were great ideas, others not so much. But that's not really the point. The point, curator Sam Lubell says, is that what happens around us is not inevitable. People can change the course of what gets built.
There has to be pressure to not let the powers that be sort of shrug it off as if it were sort of ridiculous. If we can encourage people to not give up on these projects that they believe are going to change the city for the better, that's important.
Lubell mentions a current proposal to transform the concrete-lined LA River into a vibrant waterfront. He hopes those plans don't end up in a future exhibit about what could have been. For the California Report, I'm Alex Schmidt.
LA's Never Built show ends October 13th. Unbuilt San Francisco runs till December. We've got photos of some of those buildings that could have been. Check them out at our website, californiareport.org. Twenty-four years ago, the rock duo Mazzy Star emerged from the retro psychedelic music scene of Los Angeles. It won over a devoted following with a dark, ethereal sound that was uniquely their own. Well, now the pair returns with its first new album since 1996. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman has this review.
Okay, you're a music act which a couple of decades ago had a sound all your own, a compellingly moody minimalism distinct to the point that your name was virtually a genre unto itself. Then you went away, for a long time, and in the intervening years many others took up your approach, or at least followed tangents suggested by it. And now you come back to find that what was once an open field is a very crowded landscape. What do you do? If you're the duo Mazzy Star, with Seasons of Your Day, your first album in 17 years, you set out to reclaim that territory. All of it. California. Today there stands a couple of generations of music: brooding introspection, blues country revisionism, dreamy pop, and sprightly freak folk, all making the most of the least in a way that can be called, in some measure, Mazzy-esque. On this album, singer Hope Sandoval and guitarist David Roback take us on a tour of the world they created, the originators marking it as theirs. As the nicely hazy song California makes clear, it's a new round of California dreamin'. There's still atmosphere and ambience aplenty, and with them the alluring mystique of the Mazzy heyday. But there's nothing coy here. Well, aside from Sandoval's guardedly gauzy delivery and refusal to share her lyrics in print. Even at their sparest, Sandoval and Roback are still playing in the shadows, but not hiding in them.
And all my miles away, let me know your reason. It's my mistake not to understand the seasons of your day. That you change.
They're also adding some new colors to the shadows, such as the strings here on the title song. And Spoon, a guitar duet with English folk legend Bert Jansch, recorded shortly before Jansch died in 2011, delightfully weaves his fingerpick patterns through Roback's wiry slide. Mostly, though, the new, if nuanced, directions come from Roback and Sandoval. Each has developed a wide and complex range of shadings to their art. Sandoval sighing, pouting, or simply singing, and Roback's touch moving between airily light to robustly bluesy. The latter comes to the fore as Mazzy Star evokes a classic touchstone on Flying Low, an extended psychedelic excursion that, with its reedy harmonica, reminds the Rolling Stones 60s jam Going Home. The album both starts and ends with examples of structured, even Dylan-esque songwriting, the opening In the Kingdom and the closing Lay Myself Down. As the journey concludes, Sandoval's coo is matched by a pedal steel's cry, the melody soaring and darting back and forth from the Nashville skyline to the Joshua Tree desert. And that's a distinctive, compelling geography. It's not Mazzy-esque, it's Mazzy Star.
Steve Hockman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music for the California Report. He reviewed Seasons of Your Day by Mazzy Star. Downtown LA has been enjoying a renaissance lately, especially its Gallery Row district, where, besides new lofts and restaurants, a thriving creative community has sprung up. At its heart is a giant bookstore, known for unusual art as well as for its selection of books. Reporter Colin Barry spent an evening checking out the last bookstore.
For years, Josh Spencer made a decent living selling books on eBay. In 2009, however, he decided to open his first Last bookstore downtown at 4th and Main, a modest shop of just 1,000 square feet.
I've always sort of been into science fiction and post-apocalyptic type things, so I always thought, well, what would, you know, a cool Last bookstore look like in some future civilization?
But in 2011, at the precise moment when no fewer than five big bookstores were closing in L.A., Spencer was offered a new location a couple blocks away. Ground floor of a 99-year-old Art Nouveau building, the original headquarters of Crocker Citizens National Bank. With its 25-foot ceilings and massive columns, the new space was 10 times bigger than the space he had.
I've always just sort of done my thing. I've never really paid attention to the book industry because I never saw myself as a bookstore owner or bookstore guy. So when this opportunity arrived, I didn't really think about the economy or how bookstores were doing. It was just like, oh, well, there's a space, I can do something with it.
The result is something out of a neo-Victorian sci-fi novel. The Last bookstore, as Spencer has imagined it, is more quirky than stuffy, with bicycle wheel chandeliers, a huge mural made of paperbacks, and sculptures made of books that literally fly off the shelves. One section is organized inside one of the bank's old vaults. The store trades in new and used titles, and upstairs you'll find a massive labyrinth made from used books that sell for $1 apiece. For Spencer, the store is all part of his vision.
I just kept getting sort of images of Indiana Jones at his university in the 20s, and even like sort of fantastical movies like Hellboy.
There's still a lot of people who want the physical experience of holding a book, of smelling a book, of reading from pages instead of an e-reader.
Manager Katie Orphan says opening a new bookstore at a time when others were closing was actually one of the smartest things they could have done.
We got staff that way, we got customers that way.
Besides putting on live and community events and offering a selection of zines, small publishers, and vinyl records, the store draws customers with the breadth of its inventory. While the staff sets up for a poetry reading, local shopper Alexei Calvin is scanning the shelves.
Probably the best bookstore in LA that I've been to so far. I mean, just the depth of selection is amazing. I feel like I've been here for a total of several weeks, if you add up all the hours, and I still have not delved into everything I would be interested in.
Wendy Juarez is a West Coast correspondent for Publishers Weekly. She's been in the business since 1970 and says besides its setting, the last bookstore's choice to specialize in previously read titles was one of its keys to success in a down economy.
Josh saw the potential in selling used books, not only because of the lower prices, but because the good indies can't afford to keep a well-stocked store anymore. They order one copy at a time instead of three or four like they used to.
Bless the panic that shakes me like a bone in its jaws.
As tonight's reading gets underway, manager Katie Orphan says that since the heyday of great writers such as Raymond Chandler and Joan Didion, things have been pretty quiet in the Southern California literary scene. But with a handful of new journals and small presses, and the increasing visibility of Latino and Asian writers, she sees it coming back to life.
It will be a while before we can fully challenge New York to the literary crown. But I think Los Angeles is providing so many great things, and it's great to be a bookstore that gets to encourage and participate in that.
Sound like a life that will fill the mouth with chocolate. Lord, bless the chocolate. Bless the chocolate.
For the California Report, I'm Colin Berry in Los Angeles.
Thank you guys so much.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us at californiareport.org. You can see what music we played and listen to past stories. And if you feel like it, like us at facebook.com/thecaliforniareport. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, and David Marks. Our interns are Jenny Simone and Nick Arce. The editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.